This is the Go Maluku podcast.
Another very significant element element of the UN Declaration is that all those 46 articles are interconnected. Like indigenous peoples, we all view things from a holistic point of view. Everything is related, connected with each other, which means that the declaration is also holistic, that all the articles are interconnected, interdependent, interrelated, and indivisible. Here's what a lot of states will say to you. We like the declaration, but we don't only want to emphasize one article, Article 46. Look up Article 46. Can one please read out loud what Article 46 says?
Nothing in this declaration may be interpreted as implying for any state, people, group, or person any right to engage in any activity or to perform any act contrary to the Charter of the United Nations, or construed or as authorizing or encouraging any action which would dismember or impair totally or in part the territorial integrity of political unity or sovereignty and independent states.
So what it basically says, so that's actually a direct quote from one of the basic principles of the UN Charter. The territorial integrity of states. The United Nations, like we said before, is a club of states. And like Ty said, we as indigenous peoples are like from the outside looking in. So they gave us all those 45 articles, but number 46 is the one that's the big caveat, the exception, which says you can do everything, but as long as it doesn't dismember or impair the territorial integrity of states, you can do everything as long as it's within the boundaries of the states. Don't be discouraged by that, because we had the same problem when we were in the negotiations for the Climate Change Convention last December, which states said that we're talking about Article 46. And we said that the UN Declaration is a holistic declaration. All the articles are connected to each other. One should not be cherry-picking articles of the declaration. You cannot single out one article because they're all related. We kept on hammering them with that. And they accepted that. So they took out the references to territorial integrity. Said, we respect the UN Declaration in its entirety. Which is a very good, actually, that they put into a resolution regarding climate change. The UN Declaration is what we always say is the minimum standards. So whenever you are engaging with any policy making, and to talk about indigenous peoples, talk about traditional knowledge, or everything else, or lands, or waters, look at the declaration first. Look at the declaration and check if the language that they are using is consistent with the declaration. If it's inconsistent, the declaration overrules the language that they're proposing. Because you can say, like, if we talk about waters and somebody spills water, then
it's the law of attraction.
Because when it comes to the rights of indigenous peoples, and you should always, like I said, always reflect or refer to the UN Declaration. The declaration was adopted. Who knows how many states adopted the UN Declaration? You know one in Africa?
Yeah.
All right. So that's 143 states voted in favor, 11 abstentions, and 4 against. Who voted against?
Is it Canada, US, Australia, and New Zealand?
Yes. The Kansas block, actually. It's a block of states. Funny thing is, all those states changed their position on the declaration. Not just for the fun of it, because of the pressure of the Indigenous peoples, all those lands. These are our rights. 143 voted in favor. You're the only ones that voted against. You must be insane. So they changed their position. New Zealand did a big thing. Australia did a big thing at the Permanent Forum back then. Canada did a big thing. United States changed their position to political support. I don't know what that means. But which actually tells a lot about the legitimacy of the UN Declaration. A lot of people will tell you, like Roberto said, no, the UN Declaration is soft law. Nonsense. Declarations in its essence, yes, soft law. But this particular declaration has elements of existing human rights law, which makes it customary international law. So it is very much, I won't say legally binding, but it has obligations that states must fulfill when dealing with Indigenous peoples. Indigenous peoples, our standards are not like the UN Declaration. It's a minimum standards. Our standards, it's just a perspective, it's like ethics, it's much higher. States though, like if we are here, Declaration is here, guess where states are?
Right
here, right? Whenever you go into any discussions, policy making, or negotiation with states, always aim high, always. Because you can always fall back to the minimum standards of the UN Declaration. If you aim for just for the minimum standards, they will lower. And you'll go into a fight of trying to maintain the status quo, which is the UN Declaration. If you aim high, and this is where states are, and this is the UN Declaration, states will then say, oh, you know what? Let's go to the UN Declaration then. Because they have to choose between the lesser of two evils, in their view. So that's why I always say that Indigenous peoples, or the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous peoples, are our minimum standards. So that's why, wherever you go, in terms of policy making, take the Declaration with you. And like this, who said it before, somebody said it, that we also need to educate people in the UN Declaration. So why do we need the UN Declaration in there, in everything that we have? It's the environment that you need, or we need to create, or states need to create for us if they want us. If you look around, for example, look at the program of the Permanent Forum. The main theme is traditional knowledge. There is an emergence of a certain awareness of the power of traditional knowledge. Look at climate change, biodiversity, chemical conventions, in addition to Convention on Biological Diversity, which was talked about before, World Intellectual Property Organization also talks about traditional knowledge. A lot of UN processes, even the World Trade Organization, I don't know why, are also talking about the power of traditional knowledge. Because of colonization, commodification, commercialization of our lands, territories, resources, and knowledge, we are very hesitant, of course, when it comes to like using traditional knowledge. Of course we want to contribute in fighting climate change. Of course we want to help conserve biodiversity. But it's not like, all right, this is traditional knowledge, Ben, here you go, have fun. That's not what we're here for. First of all, there's a perception out there from states that traditional knowledge is old, rusty, and dusty. It can only be found in books that are 100 years old. Whereas traditional knowledge, as you know, is like it's still alive. Like it's we keep on developing it the whole time. And traditional knowledge is not just medicine. It's not just education. It's not just art. It's also our governance system, a legal system. All the system that we have, that we are using, is based on traditional knowledge. It's based on a profound and intimate relationship with the environment, which is based on empathy, reciprocity, consent, and respect. If you ever... No. Let's talk about that. The eunuch creation is what we call the normative framework within any UN process. Let me give you an example. In the UNFCCC, so the UN Framework on Climate Change, they wanted to create this platform on traditional knowledge. The first three things that you need to do when you go into negotiations is one, you make sure that the UN Declaration is a normative framework. Two, is that you ensure that the full and effective participation of indigenous peoples is ensured. That we're not just, that they're not tokenizing us. Like, you want us in the room, you want us to contribute in terms of fighting climate change, we will be at the table. We need to be at the table. And the third is that traditional knowledge or indigenous knowledge is not an orphan of science that nobody wants to talk to. Now, science and traditional knowledge are the same, as in like they're both ways of expanding our knowledge base. So you put them both up there, not science and traditional knowledge somewhere below. So those are the three pillars, I might say, that you need to ensure when it comes to, in this case, traditional knowledge, when you create policies on traditional knowledge. So that's what we did. You create that enabling environment that's based on a UN Declaration. So an environment in which indigenous peoples feel safe. Because if you do not create an enabling environment, or an environment in which indigenous peoples feel safe, you will get paranoia, cynicism, and mistrust. And states can't blame us because colonization, commodification, and commercialization of traditional knowledge is the cause of that. So you have to do your declaration. It's the rights of it's our minimum standards, which they committed to in 2007. So just a brief anecdote. Next week, when you go present, if you're one of the lucky ones to be able to present your statement, people will tell you, like, don't move away from your seat, because if they call upon you and you're not in your seat, tough luck, they will go move on to the next one. September 13, 2007, the moment that the General Assembly would adopt the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The permanent mission of Finland invited a Sami to attend the adoption and to push the button of voting in favor during the adoption. So that Sami representative in the regalia went into the General Assembly room, and they had to go through their agenda. And the agenda item, Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, did not come up. She had to go to the toilet. So she asked her permanent representative, who was sitting right next to her, like, hey, can I go to the toilet? And he said, sure, it won't come up in another half an hour anyway. So she went. Little did she know, 2 minutes after she went, the adoption of the declaration came up. The very, very, very reason why she was in the room was to push that button. To voting in favor of the declaration, she wasn't in the room. She was in the toilet, pushing something out. And I'm not going to call out people, But that person is now extra member of the Prudent Forum. She's now an extra member of the Prudent Forum. So that's what, so the, in 2007, states committed themselves to the rights of indigenous peoples. In 2010, Bolivia said, we want to organize a world conference on indigenous peoples. Let me put it very clear. Indigenous peoples did not ask for it. We did not ask for a world conference. We only asked for the full implementation of the declaration since 2007. Bolivia, I think that was from, I think the first year of the first term of Evo Morales, who is an indigenous person, by the way, Bolivia, proposed to organize a world conference on indigenous peoples. So we had to scrap as our seven regions. So like, how do we engage with this world conference? It was not a fully fledged world conference. It was a high-level plenary meeting of the General Assembly to be known as the World Conference on Indigenous Peoples, which is the UN way of saying we want to organize a big meeting, but we don't want to pay for it. Because if you organize a world conference, there are preparatory meetings, and those preparatory meetings are sanctioned and paid for by the United Nations. So here you have a world conference to be scheduled to September 23rd, 24th, 2014, and indigenous peoples had to organize their own preparatory meetings. Now, you know from experiences like mine that organizing a meeting in your own region, or getting to New York for that matter, is an endeavor financially. Let alone organizing, for example, in the Pacific, having indigenous people from around the Pacific gather at one point. Some people have to like use boats, canoes, and airplanes and everything. So we had to do that around the world. We had to fundraise the whole time for seven preparatory meetings, which led into one big meeting of indigenous peoples held in Alta, Norway. And those indigenous peoples, 500 indigenous peoples, were flown in with two airplanes. If those two airplanes crashed, the movement would have been in trouble. Because people that you saw in those pictures, like Grand Chief Little Child, they were on those planes. 500 indigenous peoples traveled to Alta, Norway. To Roberto was one of them as well. Like, traveled to Alta, Norway to consolidate all those regional perspectives. And those perspectives are actually, what is your vision? Where do you want the indigenous movement to be? Where do you want indigenous peoples to be in X amount of time? And packaged into something that we call the Alta Outcome Document. I highly recommend you researching the Alta Outcome Document, because it actually states actually what our vision is, or what these visions of a lot of indigenous people is. The ALTA, A-L-T-A, outcome document.
What does ALTA stand for?
ALTA is a city in Norway.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the document was, so some of you, well, yeah, Roberto, oh, sure. Roberto and myself were there. It's actually a plan of action on UN system action, how the UN system must change to cater for implementation of the rights of indigenous peoples, how states must behave in terms of respecting the rights of indigenous peoples to lands, territories, and resources. There was a view on sustainable development, climate change. It's the very first collective document that indigenous peoples drafted on their own terms, outside of a UN context. It was meant for a world conference, yes. But it's a very huge document. Les Malager was one of the chief drafters of that document, and Mick Dodson as well. And Katie Kiss, and well, a lot of people in Australia, Jeff Scott. So things that we are enjoying or like engaging in right now are actually outcomes of the World Conference Outcome Document. Look, Roberto talked about the expert mechanism. It recently changed its mandate because of the World Conference on Climate. There's consultation on enhanced participation of indigenous peoples. It is an outcome of the Aalto Outcome Document. Actually, in the Aalto Outcome Document, indigenous peoples demanded, at a minimum, permanent observer status for indigenous peoples, governments, assemblies, councils. Which is a very interesting paragraph. Because that would mean that, for example, your tribal council, or indigenous council, or assembly, or Congress, would be at the same level as the state of Palestine, Holy See, United States, as a part of the General Assembly. That is something that's still ongoing, and I recommend you like participate in that process as well. Because it is another way of advocating for implementation of the UN Declaration. Look at, for example, the traditional knowledge issue. There's under the UNFCCC, there's now this platform that has the UN Declaration as a normative framework. Indigenous peoples, it's a local communities and Indigenous peoples platform. It's not just indigenous and local communities. Because, like we said before, we are peoples, we're not communities. Same as we're not civil society. A lot of states refer us as to civil society. Why aren't we civil society? Name me one organization that has rights. Only peoples have rights. So that's why you need to be very, very adamant that we are not civil society. In these peoples, assemblies, councils are not non-governmental organizations because we have our own ways of governing ourselves. We have indigenous peoples organizations at the very minimum. Roberto.
Just along that line, the other term that they've been using now in that discussion of enhanced participation is indigenous representative institutions. So that's kind of expanding how they engage with our indigenous governments.
Would you say the other term you said?
Indigenous representative institutions.
Okay.
Right, so this would encompass like tribal governments, traditional authority, different, so that's the term that they're trying to broaden.
Right.
Want to bring it in.
Thanks.
Could you explain what other groups are considered civil society, so we have a frame of reference to what we're being compared to?
Sure. Civil society can be humanitarian organizations.
NGOs,
right. Those are considered civil society organizations.
Just another way to expand that is that the basic population of a country, you know, votes on president, etc. So that's considered, that's civil action, civil political action, right? So with indigenous peoples, though, if we're saying that we have our own governance systems, that we don't necessarily fit with that. In other words, some indigenous peoples are very clear that everybody else votes for those folks, we vote for our own people. You know, and you hear this a lot in amongst traditional leadership in Canada, for example, very strong on that they have, in other words, other people vote for the prime minister, but we have our own chiefs, councils, etc. Right? So we have our own governance, and so that they're the civil society because they have to answer to that president, that Congress. We have our own people to answer to. That's the difference, really, at per se. Not every indigenous peoples are organized in the same way, and they don't all have the same argument, but that's the basis for that argument. So it differentiates us from NGOs. Hence again, why there's this discussion.
Right. Oh, definitely. And it goes to the very core principle, core right of self-determination that we have, that we can determine for ourselves, like who represents us. Who self-determination actually. There's one article in the UN Declaration that is actually a right to self-determination in disguise. But we only know it as FPIC, free, prior, informed consent.
Article 32.
Article 32. Like, so, like, everybody go to Article 32. You get a lot of what?
Indigenous peoples have the right to determine and develop priorities and strategies for the development or use of their lands or territories and other resources. States shall consult and cooperate in good faith with the indigenous peoples concerned through their own representative institutions in order to obtain their free and informed consent prior to the approval of any project affecting their lands or territories and other resources, particularly in connection with the development, utilization, or exploitation of mineral, water, or other resources. States shall provide effective mechanisms for just and fair redress for any such activities, and appropriate measures shall be taken to mitigate adverse environmental, economic, social, cultural, and spiritual impact.
So Article 32, free, prior, informed consent. Free, prior, informed consent is actually derived from the right to self-determination. It's one of the articles that you can cite. So, well, this is in violation of Article 32, right to free, prior, informed consent, for example, if there is something going on your traditional lands or happening to your traditional resources. Something that you need to keep in mind as well is that when you want to address grievances, so for example, in a violation of your rights, you do not necessarily have to go straight away to the big three. The Burn Forum on Indigenous Issues, Expert Mechanism Rights of Indigenous Peoples, or the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Because you can use a declaration in almost every and all settings. So for example, if there is something about happening on your lands in terms of housing, like Indigenous peoples have the right to adequate housing, that's actually a special rapporteur on the right to adequate housing. He or she is not indigenous, but it is a UN procedure. What you have right now is that there's a bottleneck towards those indigenous procedures. Special rapporteur is like swamped in complaints from Indigenous peoples, like trying to like have the special rapporteur address a certain situation. There's so many people at the current forum trying to address situations happening on the ground, hoping that if you read a statement, that all of a sudden the UN blue helmets will show up on your doorstep. It's like Roberto said, it's all, and Ty said, it's all about expectations. Read the mandate and know that there are so many more things out there. Morris, he just came in, and he will expand a little bit more later on about the treaty bodies, how to utilize them as well. I think it's Friday, right? Yeah. So that use the full spectrum of what's at your disposal within the United Nations, and use the declaration as a hook to go into that particular process.
My friends, that's the end of the episode, but there's more, way more. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast on your favorite podcasting platform, of course. And by the way, there are more nuggets of wisdom on YouTube. So check out my name, Ghazali Ohorella, on YouTube. Subscribe and watch your favorite movie. I don't make movies. Videos. Sorry about that. And again, thank you so much for listening, and bye-bye.